And finally, the death has occurred of Brian O'Nolan of Strabane, County Tyrone. 54-year-old Mr. O'Nolan passed away suddenly but peacefully 51 years ago tomorrow. He'll be very sadly missed and deeply and deservedly regretted by his sorrowing next...
54 years of age? That's the same age as me. That's not the greatest of innings.
Compassionate heart of Jesus, have mercy on his soul. He has gone leaning on his sieve.
54, though. That's the prime of a man's life. Miss Corrigan?
Yes, Mr. Nowell?
Can we find out more about this Brian O'Nolan, gentlemen? The name half rings a bell.
O'Nolan from Tyrone. I can make a few calls, but I still haven't got the hang of the new... telefunkin' phone recorder.
Rosebud, Miss Corrigan. Think Rosebud. Get in touch with anyone who knows anything about...
Right.
Remains will be removed to the church tonight and the funeral will take place...
Hello?
Yeah, Greg?
You'll have to excuse me, dear listeners, but a small boy has just wandered into the studio. How can I help you, young man?
I'm lost.
Well, son, you're on the wireless. This is Radio Idrona, broadcasting to the plain people of the barony of Idrone West on the banks of the Barrow.
Yeah, galore. Brian O'Nolan is Annam Dum.
Lovely, Brian. My name is Mr. Noah, but you can call me George. And aren't you a great little fella for the couple of fucko?
It's not just a few words. I only speak Irish.
You don't say.
We always had a bad smell in our house. Sometimes it was so bad that I asked my mother to send me to school even though I could not walk correctly.
The scene changes to Sing Street Christian Brothers School in Dublin's city centre. The year 1900 and stormy weather. A young boy stands among his classmates. Rain pours pathetic fallaciously.
You speak Irish!
May I state that I am a Gael. I'm Gaelic from the crown of my head, the soles of my feet. Gaelic front and back, above and below. Likewise, you are all truly Gaelic. We are all Gaelic Gaels, a Gaelic lineage. He who is Gaelic will be Gaelic evermore. I myself have not spoken a word except Gaelic since the day I was born, just like you. And every sentence I've ever uttered has been on the subject of Gaelic.
We draw a veil on this pitiful scene and return to 1966 and the violence-free studio of George Knowall, the quizzical and inquiring humorist who might be found in any respectable public house in Carlow.
Peter Hawkey. That's no way for a young man to start his education.
I thought school was going to be a lot more about books and a lot less about pucks. I ran and I ended up here, but I just want to go home.
We're in the middle of reading the obituaries now, so just 6 years there for an OMED.
George, I've discovered Mr. O'Nolan was some class of a writer. Apparently, he was lauded.
A writer? The poor fella. We are a persecuted minority. Lauded, is it? What bank can you cash that in?
Anyway, there's a message on the machine from Dr. Carol Taff. She's written a book about your man called Ireland Through the Looking Glass.
Well, he was born in Strabane and Tyrone. Probably the main influence in his childhood was the fact that the family was all entirely Irish-speaking and they didn't go to school because it was in a kind of English-speaking area that they lived. So he was kind of effectively homeschooled, and according to his brother Ciarán, he kind of taught himself how to read in English. So I think that kind of affected the way he wrote in later years, that his writing was very bookish. But then he moved to Dublin and started school at around the age of 11 or so for the first time, and that sounded like it was a kind of a slightly traumatic experience. But it did give him the kind of legacy of being a bilingual writer and being able to move quite easily between Ireland's two languages. You know, interestingly, I think the reason the family grew up speaking Irish is because his father was a very keen revivalist and wanted his children to learn the language. So perhaps there's a sense of rebelling against the parents' authority there too, you know, that he had a kind of a slightly caustic attitude towards the revival movement. His upbringing in that sense possibly shaped his view of kind of the official culture of the time or the state's support for reviving the Irish language. In a very, perhaps you could say, an artificial way. Because he was always very keenly satirical of the Irish revivalist movement and of all the kind of cultural shibboleths at the time, the kind of very traditional images of Irish culture and so on. He was a very able writer in the Irish language, but he didn't seem to have a lot of time for the politics surrounding the Irish language.
He's the very same as me. That's how I came to be 10 years of age and not a single solitary word of English do I have.
Cunis, you. Miss Corrigan, I would be much obliged if you'd continue with your telephonic inquiries. This O'Nolan chap is an enigmatic individual that I must unriddle before I can continue with the death notices.
One would have to ask, before we go further, if this is the best way to start our tale.
Sorry, why are you sticking your oar in?
A great man once said a good story could have three openings entirely dissimilar and interrelated only in the presence of the author. Or, for that matter, 100 times as many endings.
There'll be no 100 endings, I tell you that much. We have 48 minutes to wrap this yoke up.
We open on the bustling halls of University College Dublin. The year is 1931. A house debate rages in the famed Literary and Historical Society.
I'm roused about that James Joyce is the most famous person ever to be a member of this hallowed institution, which is a major cultural force in mid-century Ireland. And according to Wikipedia, our debates at this time make front page news in the national press.
We wish to rebut, deny, contradict, refuse, repudiate, contest, counter, poke holes in, and what's more, gainsay what that guy just said.
From the back of the room, from a head poking in the doorway, a comment is hurled by a hurler who is on the ditch.
You sucks. This is a load of stuff and nonsense that the cool kids would have nothing to do with. A metaphorical plague on both your houses.
That's not contributing to the debate.
I disagree.
I am literally on the outside looking in, commenting in a sardonic manner on what I am witnessing. An attitude I would sustain for much of my subsequent years as a writer.
This, perhaps, is the correct start to our story. The moment when a young literary-minded tearaway found his voice within the intellectually stimulating world of the Academy, and where he adopted his first nom de plume.
Brother Barnabas, I started my own publication, Blather. I was the toast of...
Sorry now, I prefer the first opening, where I was reading the obituary, and then I said I wanted to know who this Brian O'Nolan lad was, and then the little fella came in.
I like that one too, because I'm in it. But I also like to go home now, because I don't understand anything anyone is saying, because I only speak Irish.
So, Mr. Announcer, could you please bring us back to the studio like a good man?
Very well. We return to the rather dismal surroundings of George Knowall's provincial radio studio with its leaky pipes. And occasional vermin.
Would you stop saying that? There was no rat in here until you said there was. Yo, get out of it. I am a respected columnist in this town. I will not stand by and have my escutcheon blotted by a narrator who is not only supercilious, but entirely fictitious. Now, where was I? Yes, Brian O'Nolan. Miss Corrigan?
Yes, yes. Dr. Keith Hopper from Oxford left a message. Here, listen.
There's a reference in the late Anthony Cronin's biography about them trying, himself and his brothers, trying to build a primitive camera that they could make movies from. I mean, it ended in disaster, but it showed a fondness for the cinema, and apparently he did write early short screenplays for movies that, you know, probably ranks amongst his first writings. I think the really important point out of that is that he did have a love of film. And, like, again, like a lot of theatre modernists, this is an aspect that I think influences his writing. But the writing, I think, really took on a very powerful allure at UCT. He was involved in editing the student magazines. That's when we get his first published writings. He was part of what's been called the Golden Generation. People went on to become high court judges and lawyers, but also civil servants, and who doubled up on the side as poets. So it's very much part of a cultural environment where writing was, I suppose, not something you expected to make a lot of money from, but it was something that you could do on the side that would fulfill you creatively. And there was talk of he and his fellow students trying to write a great Irish novel called The Children of Destiny. The idea was that they'd all write a chapter each and publish it under a pseudonym. And of course, nobody else bothered doing it. But he came up with a story, and it appears in a very early student magazine called Scenes from a Novel. Very early on, I think 1932. And already you can see that he's emerging out of that, I think, very exciting time at UCD, when there was a real sense of promise, where I think the possibilities of the Irish Free State hadn't yet floundered, the idealism hadn't been entirely tarnished. So Brother Barnabas was the name he used for Scenes from a Novel, and it's a very early draft, effectively, of As Soon Two Birds. It's a metafictional story about the characters revolting against their tyrannical author. All the seeds of his major work are there very, very early on.
So, Brian O'Nolan used pen names and was a bilingual postmodernist literary prodigy. In other words, a great lad altogether.
What is that red-faced turnip snagger blathering about?
George, there's a student in the hallway and he's revolting. Like it's 1968. But it isn't. That's 2 years away.
Thank you, Miss Corrigan, for pointing out the blaringly obvious.
This show's a travesty. It's old-fashioned. It's all been done before. Radio itself is dead. It's derivative and tiresome.
Listen, you long-haired layabout. Either come in or go out. I have a short run, and I'll get to the end of these obituaries if it kills me.
I want no hand or part in this mediocrity. I'm staying where I am.
I want to go home. Hello, little fella. Where are you after coming from?
A mother and a father of a hen?
Ah, would you look at the poor unfortunate. Can't speak a word of English.
You're pretty.
Miss Corrigan, please tell me you have some further news about Mr. O'Nolan.
Oh, God, yeah. There's a message from a poet, a Mr. Louis de Puer.
I think what makes him fascinating as a writer and as a satirist is the conflict with himself, that what he most mercilessly pillories, parodies and satirizes are usually things that he has a connection with himself. He's not on the other side of the wall throwing stones at the glass houses of the next door neighbors. It's part of an assault on himself. So he satirizes the enthusiasm of Irish language activists, but he is deeply involved with and engaged with the language himself, and I think that it is the conflict with himself that makes him particularly interesting, and it speaks to a certain insecurity in him, which I think also is connected to a deep insecurity that bilingual Ireland has about itself. He shares with some of the greatest writers of the early 20th century a deep skepticism about language and the relationship between word and world. He is doubly interesting, however, because there's a particular Irish inflection in his work, which comes about as a result of Ireland's skewed bilingualism, that on the one hand he's deeply sceptical of the English language and its resources, although he deploys them with greater mastery than most others are capable of. He's prodigious in his use of English, and yet he's deeply sceptical of the claims to meaning and signification of English and all other languages. Then his relationship with Irish is also skewed. I think there must have been for him a profound shock in discovering that the language he spoke at home was idiosyncratic, in the way all families' use of language is idiosyncratic, but it's cut off actually from the language of native speakers of the language, that his own Irish is actually limited. He is an example of the Gaels he pilloried.
Most informative.
Hey guys, there's a bike out there.
Oh, stop press. Student sees bicycle.
Look, it wants to come in.
I beg your pardon? It wants to come in? Who is riding this bicycle?
That is the thing. No one. It's a phantom bike. It's as if it has a mind of its own.
Well, that's just rude. You read a few books, but you don't know your ontology from your epistemology.
It's talking! It's a talking bike!
I read about this in the Bible.
Shh, you don't understand what's going on. Miss Corrigan, would you mind showing in the talking bicycle?
Of course, George.
Thank you. Although, I must correct you there. I'm only half bicycle. I am half human, half bicycle.
That is quite interesting. You are something akin to the hybrid creatures that populated ancient myths. A minotaur, as it were.
I have been called worse. Excuse me. You don't mind if I warm myself by your fire here? I have been waiting outside the pub for hours, and it's bitterly, bitterly cold out there.
Excuse me. Comedian Dave McSavage left a message, but I don't know if he... Well, listen for yourself.
I don't think I've ever read anything by Flann O'Brien, and I've never really been into him, but I've heard people talk about him in, you know, a reverential way.
I think maybe it was of its time, and if you were living there, it was subversive and so on, but it's not something that resonates with me today. Although, having said that, I haven't read anything, so what am I talking about? But here's the thing about satire. You know, ultimately, we're powerless. You know, we're making fun of people in power. And if you do it really well, you'll piss them off. Surrealism, postmodernism, it's a way of sweetening the vicious underlying anger. And also maybe it's self-preservation as well. There's a sort of low-level self-hatred going on within Irish people. Therefore, that reflects in the kind of things that make them laugh. The darkness to the Irish sense of humour. It's reflected in theatre. You know, every play is always about some dead child or some paedophile and rain. I'm sorry I couldn't have been of more assistance to you.
Okay. That is all well and good, but I am none the wiser about this man, Brian O'Nolan.
Brian O'Nolan? That's gas. Sure isn't that the fella I was waiting for?
What?
God, yeah. I know Brian as well as myself. But carry on, don't mind me. I'm just here to take the chill off and then I'll be on my way.
No, carry on. This is most fortuitous that you should have intimate knowledge with our subject.
Intimate is right. I don't want to go into details, but I am acquainted with him on a molecular level.
This is all very edifying. Every sentence is a sermon in itself.
Another message has come in. This one's from Jocelyn Clark. He's adapted to forward the stage 3 of Brian O'Nolan's books.
So what is interesting about him is that he's still very much an underground writer. He is enjoyed by many, many people. And I think it's also he captures the imagination when you're young. I remember when I read the books and I was, I think, 14 or 15. And I completely adored them because they were unlike anything I had read up until that moment. And so what it does is that it breeds a kind of an excitement about literature in general, but just that there is such an extraordinary writer and he happens to be Irish. And also, and this I think is really important, is that he happens to be little known or less well known. And that kind of slightly left of field, outsider, slightly more obscure quality actually, I think, does him a service. If he was suddenly becomes part of the literary tourism that other writers have fallen to, I don't know if he would be any more popular, arguably, than he is. I mean, I think he's, in many ways, he is an inheritor of Joyce in terms of his subversion of forms. But I also think he's an inheritor of Joyce in terms of how he treats certain elements of the Irish psyche. I mean, it's dark, it's brooding, it's grim, it's sexually frustrated, it's slightly misogynistic, it's nostalgic in a curious way, and it's full of rage. Not only his treatment of women within the piece, but the absence of women and the absence of the female presence. And if one were to get super psychological about it, but there's an anxiety around fathers and sons and about being a man in the world, because these people are in many ways inept and naive in terms of the way that the world works and are childlike. When you go and you see, you know, very solo pieces of some of the Kushkin Yon columns about the brother, it seems to be quite bright and funny, and it's about the play and the wit. But actually, when you read the 3 novels, they're very dark and they're very violent. There's nothing sunny about the books, but what is sunny is the wit and the invention of the author.
All right, then. We are at last getting somewhere. This Mr. O'Nolan appears to have written 3 great novels that are both witty and brooding.
I'm no slouch either. When it comes to the old writing, they say I've got brains to burn. Not that I care what you people think.
Would you ever come in out of that? With all your study, have you no learned insight into our investigation?
Into Brian O'Nolan? He's a messer. If it's Irish writers you're interested in, you need to look no further than Jimmy Joyce.
For a young scholar, you lack a fierce thirst for knowledge.
Ta-ta, Darren.
Oh. Would you like a mineral? There's a small bottle of Corcoran's red lemonade for you now.
Dear Margaret, can I go home with you? You're nice.
Aren't you the little charmer? Would your mammy and daddy not miss you if you came home with me?
Oh, no, no, no. Can't go back there. Life is passing us by and we were suffering misery. Sometimes having a potato and at other times having nothing in our mouths but sweet words of Gaelic.
Ah, you poor old creature.
Badinaging bicycles, extramural undergraduates, and little boys being seen rather than heard is creating a compendium of impediments to our understanding of O'Nolan.
Hang on, there's another message. It's Eamon Morrissey, the famous actor, the brother. You know, the brother. Listen.
Growing up in Dublin in the 50s, people were talking about the column in the Irish Times, which was, you know, much more talked about than the readership of the Irish Times. So then I started reading the pieces myself, and some of them I found hilarious and wonderful. And as I kind of grew up a bit more, I was beginning to learn bits of the brother and so on, and could do them at parties and so on. And then eventually put a show together, an hour show. And then, of course, I got involved in the reading his other works, you know, Swim Two Birds, which I'll never forget. I got, as was the case for actors in those days, he went to London to be a star and became a barman, which I did myself. And then, but I read, somebody loaned me Swim Two Birds, which is out of print at the time. And I'll just never forget the weekend of reading it in this old, dreadful old bed sit I was in the freezing cold. But I just got into bed and read it, and it was just wonderful. I'd never read anything like it. Ironically, then when I came back to Dublin, he was always around. He was always this rather intimidating figure at the sitting at the bar with his big black hat. And I went and said, look, I just have to tell you, I just, you know, I read Swim Two Birds over the last weekend in London, and he ate the face off to me. Only a puerile mind could like that kind of drivel, that childish puerile drivel, you know. He was totally rejecting his own writing for the time. But you know, when I started The Brother first in 74, it was, I thought it was going to last 3 weeks at the most. It has gone on ever since, but over the years I found it to be the most difficult. I've done a number of solo shows on Joyce and Swift and so on, but The Brother is the most difficult, because the problem is you are playing a pub bore, and it's only a very thin line between being hilarious and being absolutely boring. And that is the guy. The guy is a total non-entity, a bore, and he really has no personality of his own. He's a set of opinions that has been handed down to him by, mostly by the brother, but by other people as well. And the brother obviously represents that great reactionary authority that was Ireland in the 40s and the 50s.
The door swings open, and then a jaunty little man of 40 in a chocolate brown three-piece suit bounds in, as if he owns the place.
Janie Mac, this place is like the Palace Bar on a Friday night. Chockers!
Miss Corrigan, remind me to get a lock put on that door.
How he is? That's a grand stove. Cold enough to freeze the balls off the proverbial out there.
Is there something I can help you with, sir?
Oh, no, no, God, no. No, 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 no. I'm here to help yous.
The assembled crowd, including Bicycle, look on with bated breath, with expressions, though difficult to ascertain on radio, are indubitably inquiring as to this man's identity.
The name's Nagapoli. Mr. Miles Nagapoli, at your disposal. And I know all there is to know about this O'Nolan fella. God rest his soul.
Deadly, don't be backward about coming forward with the details.
That man was a brick. The salt of the earth, a dacent skin. He was fond of the gargle, same as meself. Speaking of which, any chance of a drop of drink? Me stomach is under the impression that me throat is cut.
I'll wet the tea.
Tea? You're joking me. You won't see me drinking that Sassenach swill, born in leaves and then drinking the juice.
This is all extremely interesting and salutary. Every syllable a sermon, but I'm afraid this is not a public house.
We quickly move to the Scotch House Bar. The wooden panelled room is full of smoke and men of all shapes and sizes lowering velvety pints of an obsidian hue.
When things go wrong and will not come right, though you do the best you can, when life looks black as the hour of night, a pint of plain is your only man.
No way, we're not doing this.
When money's tight and hard to get, and your horse has also ran, when all you have is a heap of debt, a pint of plain is your only man.
No, no, you, Mr. Announcer, take us back.
But surely this is what the people want. And anyway, I've just put my order in.
We're getting off track.
This is what we want. When health is bad, and your heart feels strange, and your face is pale and wan.
Here, I'll do it myself.
When doctors say you need a change.
The scene changes back to the humble but salubrious surroundings of Radio Edrona Studios.
A pint of plain is your only man.
Lovely.
Thanks, but I hadn't actually finished.
That's enough pandering to the public. You said you were an authority on Brian O'Nolan.
God, yeah. I mean, I after telling you, I was forever in a house of ales, conversing with the man on all subjects that were fit to have their verses conned.
And?
He was a senior civil servant, though often accused of not being a bit civil. He was the personal secretary to the Minister of Yokel Government. I'd be offering all kinds of advice on dealing with, what the French might call les sauvages de boot. You know, the muck savages.
There's some fella by the name of Blind Boy Boat Club on the machine. I think that's his name anyway. It was hard to make out. It sounded like he had a plastic bag over his head.
Yeah, the one televised interview with him where he's very, very drunk. He just says in a very aggressive fashion to the camera, he says, I'm only paraphrasing him now, I'm not quoting because I don't remember, but he says, you know, I've got an intellect unlike any other man. And he said it with this aggression. And I know from psychology that if someone is speaking with that level of aggressive hubris, they're protecting themselves from a very deep insecurity. And drink is a great way to do that. The best way to protect yourself as an artist from insecurity is to use an awful lot of self-deprecation. The psychological mind state of a natural comedian is somebody who at all times is able to observe the fundamental absurdity that is behind all of life's structures, and that can lead to a great sense of meaningless if you don't have emotional awareness around it. And Flan had that. In The Third Policeman, we said the way that he describes the characters of the policeman, the constructed way that the policemen speak about bicycles, that's Flan satirizing the absurdity of the civil service that he had to live in every single day of his life. Do you know, that was Flan going, this red tape and non-stop piles of paper that I'm dealing with every day in the civil service is absurd and pointless, and it exists to keep stupid bastards in jobs. I hate this. To have a seriously strong kind of internal locus of evaluation, to be able to continually keep creating in the face of rejection, it's a tough one. When any type of art introduces comedy, when it makes the person laugh, for some reason, people tend to devalue that art. That's the one thing I'd say that really helped him. You know, to be writing in the national newspaper and for people to like your column. The most important thing for me with Flan is he invented postmodernism. Flan was doing postmodernistic type things before it was even a thing. And that's why I think that he wasn't appreciated at the time.
Maybe it was the Dyer's bag on his head, but I could have swore he kept calling Brian Flan.
He was in college with me. He regarded lectures as a joke, which, in fact, they were, if you discern anything funny in mawkish, obtuse mumblings on subjects any intelligent person could master single-handed in a few months.
Sorry, you're wrong there, buddy. You'll find O'Nolan was, in fact, a very good student. Sure, didn't he do a master's degree in modern Irish poetry and started translating Finnegan's Wake into Irish, if you don't mind?
Don't you start lecturing me about James Joyce.
You were real touchy about James Joyce.
James Joyce is God the Father.
Is he the fella that wrote that book, Ulysses?
You would know as much about great writing as a cat does about a clean shirt. Listen, James Joyce is the Father and Samuel Beckett is the Son.
And who, pray tell, is the Holy Ghost?
Well, that's easy. Flann O'Brien.
Ah, here, Flann O'Brien. Pull the other one. That fella did nothing. One book. That's all he ever did. Sold 600 copies. I have published a book.
Flann O'Brien's book, At Swim Two Birds, was the last book read by the failing eyes of God the Father, James Joyce, who called it the work of a real writer who had the true comic spirit.
What's more, my book was in Irish, on bail booked. And I wrote a newspaper column, Cruach Keen Lawn.
Oh, I write a newspaper column, Bones of Contention, going on 6 years now.
I've been writing mine for 26.
Oh.
And it was in Irish.
Go ahead, talk.
Shh. But mostly in English. Who do you write yours for?
The Nationalist and Leinster Times.
Good man, good man. Mine was in the Irish Times, the paper of record. Very popular. As was my book. Went into 3 editions, unlike Flann O'Brien with his 400 sales.
Sorry to interrupt, but comedian and actor Ardal O'Hanlon rang.
At Swim Two Birds was probably the first Flann O'Brien novel that I read. I was blown away, I suppose. It was like seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. I think probably the next day I started doodling myself, just trying to, I suppose, emulate him in some way. You know, for any aspiring comedy writer or performer, he showed you the way by, you know, the way he lampooned Sacred Cow's pretension of every sort, and it kind of gave you permission to be cheeky and bold and extravagant and very creative. It was like doors opening in your mind, you know, for the first time. So he was very definite influence in the direction that my career took. You know, I started out as part of a sketch group, and there were four of us to begin with. And we called that sketch group Mr. Trellis the Mormon. And I know there's a character, Desmond Trellis, in A Swim, Two Birds. But I don't think it was really conscious that we picked that name. It was conscious that we tried to mimic him in some way, particularly the kind of surreal flight to fancy, and then in terms of themes as well. So I think we got our unique Irish sensibility from him. You know, perhaps he created a style that we're all been influenced by, and, you know, we're all descendants of Breen O'Nuaron in a way. He still loomed large in Dublin when I was a student and sort of post-college. You know, like, we went to the same bars, you know, the Palace Bar and all those bars that he frequented. And he knew about him, and you'd still meet people who knew him. And you met an awful lot of people who still dressed like him. So apart from the work altogether, he was a role model for people like us, like would-be bohemians, you know, who were at a bit of a loose end. And, you know, we were kind of dabbling in comedy and writing, and we didn't really know what we wanted. But people like Flann O'Brien, they kind of give you a certain legitimacy, like, even if you're just hanging around pubs and bedsits and, you know, making merriment with your friends and probably dressing like a young fogey and really regretting it for the rest of your life. But at the same time, you know, he legitimized that sort of life, that kind of louche lifestyle, yeah.
A balding man in his 30s enters. He wears spectacles and a fedora with the brim pulled down and a black crombie that reaches the floor.
Truly, I tell you, he continued. No prophet is accepted in his hometown. Luke 4:22.
Oh, hello. Don't tell me you're Brian O'Nolan.
God, no. That poor man was stuck 20 years behind a desk in the civil service. Joined it when his father died to look after his family. No, I'm a novelist. At least I was. At the time when it was neither profitable nor popular.
Ah, this'll be the chap that sold the 200 books.
Flann O'Brien. Sir, it is an honour. You are a very fine writer. The man who wrote A Clockwork Orange said, if we don't cherish the work of Flann O'Brien, we are stupid fools who don't deserve to have great men. Flann O'Brien is a very great man.
You are very kind, son. There were a few men of taste who liked my debut novel.
Just not the public, what? You know, it only sold 100 copies. That's as true as I'm standing here.
I recall Dylan Thomas saying it was just a book to give your sister if she's a loud, dirty, boozy girl. Speaking of which, any possibility of a drink in this?
And wait, no.
With appropriate haste, we return to the Scotch house and...
That's better.
You came here as well. I don't remember seeing you.
I would be quietly wrapped in thought. You tended to be pontificating in the corner.
Did I ever tell you about the hangover? It's like a hangover, but in reverse.
I suppose I should have been at home writing another novel. But where does that get you?
I'm going to be a novelist. As soon as I get out of college, I'm going to be writing books to beat the band.
If, after many a summer, you find you cannot draw, then be a writer.
Ah, the novel is dead as a dodo. Newspaper columns are the real Ali Daily. Sure, every dog in the street knows that. I suppose after selling the 50 books, you never wrote another.
Oh, I did.
Whatever happened to it?
I left a manuscript on the back of the number 11 bus.
Ah, would you look at that? The swans on the sparkling Liffey. It's a grand old city all the same.
Joyce wrote a whole book about the Liffey.
Perhaps I should have taken a leaf out of his book and moved abroad. Maybe they'd build a bridge in my honour.
Would you go way out of that? They don't build bridges for writers. For writing, it's a wall you need. So where is it you left your book, anyway?
I'll look.
You know, even Hitler tried to destroy my career. That's not word of a lie. The Luftwaffe dive-bombed my novel in London.
I met Erwin Schrödinger once. He didn't even have a cat. Maybe he had when I wasn't looking.
Can't see it anywhere.
Maybe I left it on the back of me bike.
There was a grand talking bike in the studio. It wouldn't be yours by any chance.
Oh, hello, lads. You decided to come back, did you? Did you find out anything more about Brian O'Nolan on your travels?
It has to be here somewhere.
Patrick McCabe, the man who wrote The Butcher Boy, left a message. He's practically a neighbour of O'Nolan there in Monaghan.
It's a long time since I've read him. I love him, but I haven't really read anything by him. Well, I mean, he hasn't written anything new in the last couple of years. What Flann O'Brien considered his kind of amusements or detritus, other people would give their right teeth to be able to write. We were at an exhibition in Princeton about 10 years ago. It's an Irish writers kind of thing, and they had the letter from, I think, Longmans to Flann O'Brien. I think it was for the third policeman, the rejection of the third policeman, a carbon copy of the letter. And they're very short, but more or less said, we admired your first book at Swim Two Birds, but he will recall that we asked you in your next work to curb your fantastic tendencies and to go more realistic. Unfortunately, we see from the new manuscript that you've gone the opposite direction and you've become more fantastic, and we don't think this works. And I think that really, because the third policeman he knew was a masterpiece. Apart from the crazy humour and all that, it's really about existential loneliness, and that's why it's a masterpiece. And it's about drink, and it's about dread, and it's about unhappiness. And that's why it's his greatest work. And the rest of it is good, but it's not up to that. And there's an interesting kind of language that's developed in it too. It's almost like combinations of Hibernian English and Standard English. You know, these collocations of almost like Swedish English, which really dislocate you at every turn. You keep slipping off the sentence, as it were, sideways. And it really emphasizes the dread. The style and form are perfectly in sympathy. It has its own weird kind of signpostings and trademarks, whether they're bicycles or player cigarettes. But they're just the iconography of the world it creates. You know, it's not a real Ireland anyway. It's just an aspect of it.
There's no sign of it.
Be careful where you're putting your hands, young man.
Sorry, I'm not trying to be familiar. I'm just looking for this man's manuscript.
That's the best one yet. Looking for a manuscript, Marja. I'm not hanging around here to be mauled by spotty undergrads. I'm hitting the road. Good night.
Would you ever give over? He's only spoofing you. That manuscript is not lost. It's sitting on his dressing table above in his own house.
What? Is that true?
I sent it to a publisher, but it was rejected.
But you have a book. You've written a masterpiece. You're the next James Joyce.
What? And produce another wallet of literary underwear?
You have to get it published.
And have fanatics like you squandering your youth pouring over every poxy ward. Get out of me way. I'm going to the pub.
Did you see the way he leapt out that door? He's not much of a rider, but he can jump. Then again, that's the one thing the Irish race is honoured for no matter where it goes. Everywhere and all the time, it is hats off and a Grand Macree to the jumping Irishman. A thing that will always stand to us. The jumping.
You smug, self-righteous swine, self-opinionated, sod-minded, suet-brained, ham-faced, mealy-mouthed, streptococcus-ridden gang of natural gobdaws.
I don't know what to make of that, carry-on.
Such language to be used in front of a child. Ah, there, little lad. I'm sorry you had to hear the bad man shouting. Oh. What's happening?
Dear listeners, a change has come upon the room. Indescribably subtle, yet momentous, ineffable. The temperature of the evening has altered greatly in an instant. The air has become twice as rare and twice as dense.
The boy!
Mercy,
the boy!
Well,
would you look at the boy!
He's changing!
He's growing in size. His fingers are stretching.
The boy's a changeling. A shapeshifter.
McFellamy's the name. Member of the Divil class.
But why did you come as a child?
I wanted to see if you'd take me in your bosom.
That was sticking out a mile. I knew that's what he was up to the whole time.
And that, Miss Corrigan, is precisely what you did.
I did, but that's when you were a small child.
Children have a habit of starting out as one thing and ending up another.
But I can't take you home as my child now that you're a fully grown...
Pooka, Miss Corrigan. I'm a pooka, and you have no choice in the matter. You have to take me home. And at this point in our relationship, the only dignified option would be to do so as your husband.
This is all very sudden. But since you put it like that, I'll get my coat. By the way, George, Tommy Tiernan just rang.
For me, the parts of his work that I most respond to are the columns. The novels tend to be written in a style that I find very hard to connect with, slightly arch to my eye. It's a very educated vernacular, whereas the columns, I find, even though there's great education in them, they're common too. You know, they haven't lost their common touch. And it's because it's funny in an Irish way. It's not, you know, kind of P.G. Woodhouse funny. It's really Irish, but, you know, fellas drinking too much and ending up disguising themselves as cattle to be sold at a mart in Manchester. It's just brilliant. It's fantasist, rooted in poverty and verbally indulgent. I think they're the hallmarks of an Irish humorist, you know, I feel anyway. We don't really do one-liners, you know, wisecracks. We don't really do a comedy of manners. It's about imagining fantastical situations and having a bit of crack with them. To be artful and funny in a newspaper column is a phenomenal achievement, and it's in a phenomenally democratic platform. It's available every day. As an art form, the columns have been underrated, I think. You know, people might think of him as a failed novelist when he wasn't. There's also, now I know he was probably bound to because of the civil service job, but there's a genius in using pseudonyms, because you create a character then who isn't tied down by biography. One of the things I find very interesting about him is the fact that he's from the North. We haven't, in the Republic, we haven't embraced that much stuff that's come down from the six counties. We can often imagine our northern cousins as being slightly more uptight, not really as Irish as we are, certainly not as up for the crack as we are, and then bowl down this man from Tyrone, who's the funniest Irishman that ever put pen to paper. I've never come across a writer as brilliant as him, or as funny, or as prolific. It's astounding.
This is hellish. I feel like we're going around in circles. All this talk about Flann O'Brien and Miles na Gcapallín. I just wanted to know, who is Brian O'Nolan?
Oh, I can help you with that. You, Mr. Know-All, are Brian O'Nolan.
That is not possible. For starters, Brian O'Nolan is dead. I read his death notice.
Who's to say you are not dead?
Dead? How can I be dead? I have a column to write.
Seems you've met with a deadline of a different order.
Where are we in that case? Is this heaven?
Is it hell?
Could be limbo. Could be Carlo.
But I was alive a second ago. I was in the prime of my life.
Is it life?
He answered.
I would rather be without it.
He said.
For there is a queer small utility in it. You cannot eat it or drink it or smoke it in your pipe.
But I'm only 54.
It does not keep the rain out. And it is a poor armful in the dark if you strip it and take it to bed with you after a night of porter when you're shivering with the red passion. It is a great mistake and a thing better done without, like bed jars and foreign bacon.
I'm ready, Pooka. Shall we take our leave?
There's little else to take at this stage in the game. I bid you farewell, gents.
Goodbye, George. Oh, before I go, novelist Julian Gough called.
I think there's a tremendous battle in Flann O'Brien between his religious faith and his own exploration of ideas and reality and his own. I think his own intellectual journey took him beyond his faith and he went back, he retreated in horror. I think that explains a lot of the drinking and a lot of the lack of productivity in the later part of his life. I think he frightened himself. I think he wrote a book in The Third Policeman, the implications of which horrified him, and I don't think he really recovered from that. I mean, he wrote books afterwards, but I don't think he ever had the intellectual daring that he had in The Third Policeman after that. And if you look at when he revisited it in the Dorky Archive, he loads the dice against science and against Joyce and against the intellectual adventure and in favour of faith. I think he was too in awe of James Joyce and too annoyed with himself for being in awe of James Joyce. He shouldn't have given himself such a hard time. He was way better than Joyce at loads of things. He was way better than Joyce at being funny. He was way better than Joyce at being madly creatively imaginative. He's different to Joyce and he's just as successful in his own different way. And I wish he'd known that. But he didn't get enough success in his own lifetime to... I think he needed someone outside him to tell him how good he was. And the world didn't tell him that. The world wouldn't even publish The Third Policeman. So he didn't get the boost he needed. I get very sad when I think about Flann O'Brien. If he knew how much we love him now, he needed it then and he didn't get it. I mean, Lost was really influenced by Flann O'Brien. You know, the third series of Lost. Oh, it's the doorbell. My wife. Hang on. I will let her in and I will come back to you. Hang on 1 second.
I am agog.
Well, isn't that a conundrum of inscrutable potentialities? A snorter.
I was dead this whole time. That's why I felt such an affinity with the Bowel Brian. We were sharing humanity's ultimate state of inexistence.
Holy moly. Between the jigs and the reels, that was an evening like no other. Which begs the question, what happens to order?
It is restored. What does one do with a suggestion?
One throws it out. For what does one throw out a suggestion?
For what it is worth. What else can be thrown out?
A hint. In addition to hurling a hint on such lateral trajectory, what other not unviolent action can be taken with it?
It can be dropped. In what direction should you shoot?
Up. And like that, the man in the brown suit was gone, and the studio began to fold in on itself into an identical room of half the proportions. And indeed, that smaller room with all its miniaturized contents conflated down into an identical one of half its size again. And so on and so forth.
But wait. We can't disappear. I don't think we answered the question. Who was Brian O'Nolan?
A wise man once said, a good question is very hard to answer. The better the question, the harder the answer. There is no answer at all to a very good question.
Your talk is surely the handiwork of wisdom, because not one word of it do I understand.
In Bones of Contention by Mark Ivan O'Gorman, Flann O'Brien and Brother Barnabas were played by Jack Lowe.
Miles Nagopoline, the posh announcer, and Pooka McFellamy were played by Kevin Marin. Brian O'Nulon, the Atomic Bicycle, and Miss Corrigan were played by Rachel Ra. George Knowall played himself.
Dramatization recorded by Brian Wallace. Original music and sound design by David Ayres. Existing works have been plundered. A Cleverality production. Excerpts from various works of Brian O'Nolan have been quoted liberally throughout the piece.
Contributions by Blind Boy Boat Club, Jocelyn Clark, Dr. Louis Dupuyer, Julian Goff, Dr. Keith Hopper, Pat McCabe, David McSavage, Eamon Morrissey, Dr. Carol Taff, and Tommy Tiernan.
Bones of Contention was written and produced by Mark Ivan O'Gorman and was a Cleverality production for RTE Lyric FM.
This week's Lyric feature was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. The producer for Lyric FM was Owen O'Kelly.
And that programme, Bones of Contention, is available to podcast now from the Lyric feature webpage and from Apple Podcasts, Spotify and a whole load of other places. You can contact the programme by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.